Thanks, everyone, for joining us. Depending on where you are, good morning or good afternoon, and welcome to our first quarter results conference call. I'm here today with Matt Weber, I think most of you know, our Group Chief Underwriting Officer. You'll have all obviously had a chance to take a quick look at our first quarter results. You'll see we started the year with a very strong first quarter. All business units contributed positively to the group net result, income of $1.4 billion U.S. P&C Re, as it has done for many quarters now, led the way, continuing to demonstrate disciplined underwriting and also benefiting, of course, from the benign Nat Cat experience. Important, the results of Life Insurance Re reflect the benefits of the management actions that we concluded last year. And I think at this point we can say, although it's still early days, it's just one quarter, but the segment is on track to achieve its 2015 ROE target. Corporate Solutions delivered a set of strong results driven by continued, albeit somewhat slower pace, profitable business growth. Admin Re generated gross cash in line with our expectations and, of course, had an exceptionally a positive Q1 off the back of some realized gains. Our group SST solvency ratio associated with our SST1 report remains very strong at 223%, down about 16 percentage points from the comparable report last year, but I think still reflecting a very strong capital position. The decrease, of course, comes from a number of items, our business mix, but also, of course, the level of interest rates today versus where we were a year ago, an update of our life and health model, as well as, I think, quite importantly, the impact of projected capital actions, which this year also then will include the impact of the recently approved share buyback program. So with that, I'll hand it over to our head of investor relations, Philippe Brahin, who's going to introduce the Q&A session.
Many thanks, David, and good day also to all of you from my side. And before we turn to the Q&A, I would like to remind you again, as usual, to please restrict yourself to two questions each and re-register for follow-up questions. So, operator, we can start the Q&A session, and can we please have the first question?
First question comes from Inyo Guan, Goldman Sachs. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. This is Ian from Goldman Sachs. So two questions for me. The first one is on the P&C acquisition ratio. That seems to have increased 4 percentage points year on year. I understand this is driven by having more proportional business in your book. So just wondering if that's a pure mix effect, or have you seen higher level of commissions year on year? And the second one is on the $3 billion that's to be deployed by the end of the year. I think you updated last time saying that 750 to 800 has been deployed. Has there been any more deployed since then? Thank you.
Matt, if you'll take the first question, I'll wrap around with the second.
Okay. It is both of the above. We wrote a little bit more proportional business than the quarter before, so it is a business mix issue, and on top of this, we have seen a slight, not a dramatic, but we have seen a slight increase on the commission ratio as well.
So just on that, so with the 24% acquisition ratio, is that going to be sort of the run rate going forward, or is there sort of one-offs in there as well?
It depends on the mix of business we are going to write. So it's impossible for me to confirm or deny that this is going to be the ratio forward. It will be subject to some variability.
So let me then come back to your second question. So you're correct. At the end of last year, we said we deployed approximately $800 million of that $3 billion. And that $800 million went to a number of different, let's say, more tangible, discrete purposes, the further expiry of the Berkshire quota share, admin re deal we did in Q2 of last year, plus the two acquisitions that we announced on behalf of Corporate Solutions. At this point in Q1, there have been no further significant discrete applications of that capital. If you wanted to pencil in something, but I would really encourage you just to pencil it in, you can clearly see that we've announced a further special dividend this year, as well as a potential share buyback. Altogether, those two would add up to potentially $2 billion during the course of the year. But those are just penciled in numbers at this point.
If I may, I would like to add a statement to the answer relative to your first question. One thing to consider is also the fact that on a number of proportional treaties, we either have a sliding scale structure or a profit commission involved, which has exactly the same cash flow impact. And in years where the loss ratio is, or in quarters where the loss ratio is low, for instance, as a result of a good underlying result or a benign net cat environment, both of which is the case, that automatically leads to a little bit higher commission ratio.
Okay, shall we go to the next question?
Next question comes from Michael Huttner, JP Morgan. Please go ahead.
Fantastic, thank you very much. So on the pricing, I just wondered if you can give a little bit of color. My feeling is it's actually improved, but I may be wrong. So the figures I have in mind was 108 pricing adequacy in January 14, 107 April 14, 105 Jan 15, and 105 April 15. So the gap, if you like, has narrowed. It was a fall of 3 points at the start of the year. It's now down 2. So is pricing actually going up, or am I mistaking here? I know this is really unfair question. You might say, what's the underlying ROE? The numbers are fantastic. Gains is good, as cash and no claims is also good. But I'm trying to guess, and I can't. I don't have much of a feel. I see this amazing number of 16%, and I just wondered. I can't work it out. Thank you.
Okay. Once again, I'll ask Matt to pick up the first question. I'll come back on the second, Michael.
Okay. So, with respect to the price quality numbers which you stated, your memory is flawless. These are exactly the numbers which we experienced and which we disclosed. Please remember the 105. That's a year-to-date adequacy, and so was the 107%, which we experienced and disclosed last year. So 105 is obviously lower than 107, which means the price quality has deteriorated a little bit. But overall, I think the observation that the decrease, actually, the price decrease have slightly decreased relative to the year before. I think that's a correct statement.
Okay, then let me come back to the results and the ROE. First off, indeed, quite a strong set of results. All four of the business units contributed. This was a quarter where actually those things that maybe could have gone positive tend to go positive across all the different units. It obviously doesn't happen that way all the time. We recognize that. We don't really calculate, provide underlying ROE. Everyone does it a little bit differently. If you look at slide 5 of our presentation, you'll see what we try to say very consistently now is that our business is about long-term performance, not individual quarters. Of course, we have benign periods in that cat. We have periods where there are larger losses. You see that reflected here. We have prior year reserve releases that come across. Typically, people look at that somewhat as one-off, unsustainable. But if you back them back through the years, you'd see that our overall combined ratio, as reported, will, I think, very clearly show a very positive trend. Likewise, on the investment side, we did, I think, for very specific reasons, try to help a little bit the assessment of the life and health re results, because we had that very significant 117 million FX remeasurement in Q1. You may recall last year, Q1, we actually had a negative FX impact. But if you back some of the quote-unquote volatility out of our life and health re-figures, you'll see then that we get to an overarching underlying result of roughly 160 million or so, just back to 117 out of the 277. There are a couple of offsetting adjustment pluses and minuses. And that's why we calculate that underlying ROE for you, because we recognize that the FX impact in Q1 was significant and clearly no indication that that would be recurring.
Thank you.
Next question.
The next question comes from Cameron Holter, RBC. Please go ahead.
Hi, afternoon. I've got two questions. The first one is sort of a long one, so apologies in advance. Just noticed in your slides you're talking about the protection gap. Now, obviously there's potential for, really, really, really fantastic growth there over the long term. And if we look at the industry, some of the life companies have been given, huge credit for that potential, but reinsurers are really less so. I'm guilty of having kind of flat top line in my model. Could you talk a little bit about how much of the protection gap is actually technically insurable? And secondly, why that business might come to Swiss Re rather than any kind of local incumbent, whether they be kind of private enterprises or kind of government-backed schemes? Thanks.
Okay, so I'll take the first question and the second question, and if I invite David to add. If he likes to, so how much of this protection gap is technically insurable? Actually, a significant portion of it is insurable. One of the reasons why insurability is limited is for some people in some region. While they needed insurance, it's just not affordable for them, given the fact that they do not have the money to spend, or the money they have. They have other more urgent priorities. So we do have to take that into account. However, there, for instance, in California, as an example, protection gap on the Nat Cat side, after the Northridge earthquake, the insurance penetration on the personal line side was of the order of 40%. Now the insurance penetration has dropped to a single digit number, which California is, there are a number of people in California who actually could afford buying earthquake insurance, and the same is true with respect to life insurance and health insurance. So there is a lot of upside potential there. Why will these people come to Swiss Re? The reason is we invest actually a lot. We are working on initiatives on the microinsurance side in order to make sure that we reach also the population that cannot afford to buy huge amounts of insurance and need to restrict themselves to buy the absolute minimum. We are working with governments in order to increase the insurance penetration in general and assume some of the risks. It's work incentive, and success will not come overnight, but eventually it will come, and a portion of it will reach Swiss Re.
So if I may, I'd like to add a few comments. And I'd like to start by actually just thanking you for the question. I know we're here, we're talking about Q1 results, and probably a lot of interest in that. But ultimately, I think for the long-term value proposition of the insurance sector, and specifically for Swiss Re, I think thinking a little bit about this protection gap is actually a very important thing to do. If you actually just take a look at that graph that we provided on slide 15 of our presentation, and just take a couple of the years that have the peak losses, so around 95, 2005, 2011, you think about where those losses were coming from. Those losses were basically coming, by and large, from the developed markets. And the protection gap that you're seeing here is, by and large, a protection gap in the developed markets. Clearly, the market, I think, is in many respects ready, available, technically insurable. This is about, I think, the insurance sector, and hopefully Swiss Re can support that, doing a better job about explaining the value of insurance and making sure that people really are thinking about insurance in a proper way as part of an overall risk management approach. A little bit more detailed in some of the higher growth markets, it's true, of course, that some of those markets are not yet fully ready for the full suite of reinsurance product for various reasons. But we're on the ground. We have a foot on the ground. In many markets, we've been there for some time, building relationships, also relationships with the various regulatory bodies, increasing our understanding database in those markets. In those markets that are not yet and maybe won't be ready for another several years, we look for opportunities to also invest a little bit more directly. Some of our principal investments over the last couple of years have been specifically targeted at those markets that may not yet be fully ready for the reinsurance, but we still see a very clear protection gap and opportunity on the primary side. And the final thing I'll say is this protection gap that we're talking about is not just it's not a short-term thing. We see, if you just look at the economic developments, population growth, the concentration of value in certain areas that are clearly exposed to some of the Nat Cat risk, amongst other reasons, also just due to climate change coming at us. We see that this is going to be a prolonged opportunity, and also an opportunity ultimately for us to help society, but also clearly to position Swiss Re well for our shareholders. So it's a very important subject. I wish we could get a little bit more attention to it. I think when we have events such as Nepal, it just underlines once again what a tragedy is when you have those types of events and basically realize that all those losses will really fall on the shoulders of the individuals and or the state, and there hasn't been much insurance protection provided into that market, and I think that's a call to action for all of us. So thanks for the question.
David, Matt, thanks so much for the answer. Really fantastically comprehensive. Thank you.
All right. William, shall we go to you?
Next question comes from William Hawkins, KBW. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks very much. David, could you provide a clearer reconciliation of the available capital in your Swiss solvency test from the last figure for SS2 to the current figure, so the 55.4 to 52.6? I think I know the moving parts you've mentioned, but if you could just help on some of the numbers. And then as we look to the future, is it almost inevitable that the Swiss solvency test ratio is going to continue to fall? I mean, it seems to me you're so way above where you want to be anyway that you wouldn't mind if it did. At least at the moment, you seem to be clearly distributing more than you're creating economically. And, you know, because you're still a growth business, or because you still see the growth opportunities, the required capital is growing. So it seems to me obvious that the SST ratio is going to keep on falling. But I just want to see if there's anything I'm missing.
Okay, thanks, William. Let me start with the second. Well, frankly, if it would continue to fall, that indeed would not be something that would cause us grave concern. Obviously, it would depend on what would be driving it. But the fact of the matter is our overall target for SST has remained at 185%. That target allows us to position ourselves to be available to write good business and support our clients even after very large losses would have occurred. So basically provides us with a capital buffer that would give us comfort that we would remain above an SST 100% level even after a shortfall type of event. So in and of itself, the fact that our ratio would move in the direction of 200 or even 185 is not something that would cause us concern. And you're right, we're looking to either deploy our capital, our excess capital, intelligently and good profitable business, or looking for ways to give it back if we can't find the investment opportunities over the short to medium term. So that's the answer to your second question. I guess that's a confirmation. In terms of the first question, I won't give you line by line, but I will give you a couple of walks, both to the SST2 that you mentioned, as well as to the SST1 from last year. And probably fair to say the SST1 from last year is more comparable, just given the nature of the two different reports. So let me just start with your specific question, which was the comparison of SST2 2014, where we're at 249% to the 223% today. Our RBC basically dropped about $2.8 billion, as you mentioned. It went from 55.4 to 52.6. offsetting factors. Clearly, we now have in the SST1 the whole capital management expectation for the year. So the SST2 doesn't have that, but SST1 does. We have the special dividend that we've declared, as well as the share repurchase program, pro rata, if you will. There's an assumption that we make about that, but it's pro rata for the 12-month between our AGM earlier this month and the AGM next month. We have some negative foreign exchange impacts. We have some previous year's business negative impacts for the losses that we announced and we recognized on the life and health side in the second half of 2014. So basically a true-up for all of the final actions there. And we have, of course, on the positive side, new business results. We have some further P&C reserve releases, although you'll have seen, no doubt, that the reserve releases in Q1 this year were significantly lower than what we had seen in last year, but still positive. We have the impact of the sale of Aurora, which is now fully included. We have outperformance on the investment side, and of course we have issued some new supplementary capital. So that's what basically has driven the RBC figure from the June 30 figure of last year to the now new SST1 figure of this year. More or less the same items impact us on the comparison SST1 to SST1, although the difference there is a more modest 16%, and therefore I think it's probably fair to say that the capital management actions probably play a little bit of a larger role there. There's no doubt that interest rates overall, if you look at the ratio, both sides of the equation, further decline in interest rates has have driven our ratio down a little bit more, and we have enhanced, i.e. we've increased the granularity of our life and health model, so we now have a much better, I think, view on premium risk associated with those long-term transactions, and that more granular view leads to a higher runoff capital cost. So those would be both sides denominator as well as numerator of that ratio.
That's very helpful. If I can just follow up, you may have a short answer for this, but I think you are implying in your formal comments on the website that you reckon your Solvency II ratio for the group, if you were to calculate one, would be higher than the Swiss Solvency Test ratio because the SST regime is more conservative. If I've understood that directionally correctly, would you care to quantify how much higher your Solvency II ratio could be versus SST?
I won't quantify it. I think I actually made some relevant comments in July at our last investor meeting where I said that for some of the specific entities where we are looking at the Solvency II ratios, the level could be as much as 40% higher, i.e. more robust under the Swiss Solvency Test. You know, the finalization of Solvency II is still remaining to be concluded, although the implementation now is becoming very close. We're looking for the final directives to be put into law by the various national governments. Still getting some updated guidance from EIOPA regarding specific aspects of Solvency II. I think what's fair to say, and we remain convinced about that, looking at a number of our specific legal entities where we do have a full slate of Solvency II reports available, as well as we have the Swiss Solvency Test information available in those same legal entities, that the Swiss Solvency Test has proven to be quite robust and I think also quite conservative, and that's perhaps also reflected in the manner in which it was able to achieve equivalence recently from the various regulatory authorities, still waiting for the political authorities to agree that. But I think the equivalence progress of Swiss Solvency Test has been a testament to the robustness of the regime.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next question comes from Mr. Thomas Sadler, Sanford C. Bernstein. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. Good afternoon. Two questions on investment management, please. First, realized gains in Q1 were, you know, as high as they were in the full year 2014, and it reads and sounds a bit like you did quite some change in the asset mix in Q1. So my question is, you know, can you provide a bit color on what you did in Q1 and whether we should think about this a front-loading of realized gains for the year, or do you plan further actions for the remaining of the year and hence further realized gains? Second question, the regular investment income, the more important source, I would say, you had a drop 40 basis points versus last year Q1, where you benefited from the re-risking 2013. My question is now, because you indicated you didn't use capital so far should we think about further re-risking and hence, you know, mitigation of the further drop of the regular investment income, or is it just that you let it run and without any re-risking now?
Okay, thanks for the question. First, let me just be very clear. There's no front running of realized gains, and there's no attempt across the group to somehow proactively realize gains as a strategy driven by our P&L. There is one area specifically within Admin Re where we did target some asset portfolio repositioning in advance of Solvency II. We're required to do that during the course of this year, and our intent is to do it during the course of the first half, so there may be some follow-up during Q2 there. But other than that, I think the gains that we would have seen across the organization are just normal portfolio-driven moves. We did move out of some of our covered bond positions. If you just think about what the impact of the ECB's action has been on the covered bond market, driving spreads down to minimal levels, we thought it was hard to justify continuing to hold those, so we sold some of those. Otherwise, what we've been doing is basically moving a little bit more cash primarily into the government bond, relatively shorter term government bond holdings. And we have picked up a little bit of extra credit, altogether about $1 billion. Now, it's in the form of an equity ETF, but anyway, it's just credit exposure. But that is, I think, if you just look at the overall size of the portfolio, we basically maintain the same relative position. So to answer your question, no targeted acceleration of gains into Q1 for any purpose. The only specific thing that we did that I think is somewhat out of the ordinary was just related to the preparation for Solvency II in our UK operations. As to your second question, the fact of the matter is, for all savers and all investors, and certainly long-term investors, the prolonged low interest rate environment has a very significant, and it will continue to have a significant impact on us. And as we need to reinvest just with the normal maturities of our existing asset portfolio, of course, our reinvestment rates are lower than what we will currently have on our books. Now, we're not going to try to counter that by going down the credit curve line. So we're going to maintain a good high-quality portfolio. We also want to avoid exotic structures. We don't think that our balance sheet is the right place to have those kind of things. Maybe there's some others who feel a little bit more comfortable having those on their balance sheets. But we want to maintain a very straightforward, understandable, appropriately structured and balanced asset portfolio. It may well be that if the rates and the short end of the curve continue to be quite negative, that we'll go out a little bit longer in certain currencies. We clearly still have an interest in seeing the infrastructure bond market continue to develop to become an investable and tradable asset class for a long-term holder such as ourselves. But coming back to your question and being very specific, we're not going to go reach for yield in order to try to counter the lower interest rate.
Okay, so no redeployment, no major redeployment of capital on the investment side then?
Well, of course, we'll have to watch what happens in the markets. I can't preclude that we're going to adjust our portfolio depending on things that happen. But if you looked at what we did in Q1, actually quite a steady-as-she-goes type of asset portfolio development during the quarter. And I think we're positioned where we would like to be. It gives us a solid performance. I think it's well positioned in terms of looking at fair values that are out in the market today, and it reflects our asset liability matching strategy, and it reflects our duration. So I think we're actually well positioned. We'll continue to watch the market to see what how it develops and whether or not moves will be appropriate. But at this point in time, nothing planned.
All right. Thanks a lot, David. Very clear.
Thanks.
Question comes from Andrew Ritchie, Autonomous. Please go ahead.
Oh, hi there. The first question for David. David, just following up on the previous question. I think you had suggested we should expect roughly 20 basis points of running yield decline over the course of the year. I mean, given, I'm assuming your reinvestment rate over Q1 was probably lower than you anticipated, and obviously you've realised a lot of bond gains. Is that still... Should we assume, you know, a higher degree of yield, running yield compression? Maybe just update some of the guidance on that would be useful. Second question for Matt. On Corporate Solutions, Gross premiums written fell about 20% year on year. I appreciate that's because there was some multi-year business written Q1 last year, but I'm just trying to judge what's the underlying growth rate. I mean, I think the underlying is still shrinking now in corporate solutions, or maybe just give us a sense, is that because you've got meaningfully more cautious on the pricing environment there, or should we see more growth pick up later in the year? Thanks.
Okay, so I'll take the second question first. So you're absolutely right with respect to your remark related to the multi-year transaction. And another impact is of course, related to FX with the recent strengthening of the US dollar. The underlying business is growing, but in reflection of the softening market environment, which has also reached the primary insurance side in the meantime, we have reduced the pressure on the gas pedal. And as a result of this, the growth of the fundamental underlying growth of the portfolio, while it's still positive, the growth rate has reduced relative to the year before.
What was the growth ex multi-year? 2 or 3% or something?
I cannot give you the exact number, but it's a single-digit number.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, Andrew, let me come back then to your first question. So you're right, we had indicated that we thought that the running yield may drop by about 20 basis points, so basically going from the 3.2 that we had in the year down to about 3. That's more or less where we ended up this quarter. I would say that given specific moves, particularly on the short side, where we took some cash and invested it in short term, and maybe a little bit of a disproportionate impact in Q1, so I wouldn't necessarily extrapolate that for the entire year. I mean, we're 3 months in, so maybe, I don't know if we're 3 months smarter, but anyway, we're 3 months more experienced. So if anything, I would say the overall guidance that we gave of about 20 basis points down, I may adjust it slightly to 20 to 30 basis points down versus last year, but I think it's still in the ballpark.
Do you have any sense what you were reinvesting at on average over Q1?
I do have a sense, overall about 1.6, but as I mentioned, that reflects specifically the actions that we took during Q1, so that's not necessarily indicative of the entire year. And that 1.6 is a mix. We primarily were investing in short-term U.S. treasuries, as it turns out, so a big part of our net investment went into short-term U.S. treasuries at about 1.3.
Right. Okay, that's very helpful. Thank you.
Thanks.
Next question comes from Andy Brookfield, Barclays. Please go ahead.
Oh, hi there. Two questions. I'm sorry to come back to solvency, guys. I'm still, it's a bit of a fog for me to try and exactly understand what's gone on. So my first question is, the reconciliation you gave, that was that 2.8 billion reduction. I know you don't want to be down to the sort of nearest dollar, but the big moving part is the capital repatriation. Which is, I think, still a little under $2 billion. And then the net of all the other bits, I mean, you obviously didn't give any guidance on the FX, but I believe the recapture was actually quite a small negative number, and then a load of positives. So I still can't see where sort of $1 billion plus of that has come from. And I think kind of we need to for a company that has a relatively low, at least optically very low, interest rate sensitivity. I think that's a gap that I'd like to better understand. And the second question is, you talk about the 185%, which has been your guidance for some time, on SST that you want to be above. My understanding is, and I appreciate your clarity on this, is that the S&P requirements is probably a little north of or there's been a bit of a departure between the S&P requirements and your SST numbers. I wonder if you can just tell us a little bit about if that's right, and if so, where that's coming from, and any actions you may or may not be taking to try and redress that sure. gap that both is up.
Sure. Okay. So look, there are two different numbers, of course, that impact the ratios, both the RBC And indeed, a big component of that drop comes from the special dividend and share repurchase. Relatively modest impact from the life and health actions because, indeed, we'd already recognized a good part of that earlier. And the final thing, of course, is just the FX impacts that go both ways. I mean, this time there were a negative impact. But also impacting the ratio, of course, was the enhancement that I mentioned on the life and health model, as well as the decline in interest rates, which does impact the target capital because it impacts the discounted rate of the liability. So the interest rate moved from the beginning of 2014 to the beginning of 2015 was just a material move. To your second question, you're right. So we don't want to adjust our targeted ratio every quarter, every year. I'm exaggerating a little bit. So we give a long-term view, and we said 185% SST, because if we think about what a shortfall event would be, that would still allow us to be in excess of 100% and therefore still working with our clients and supporting their needs as opposed to having intense dialogues with regulators after such an event. We think that's a differentiating factor for us. At some point in the past, because there are two systems, SST is more or less fully economic, S&P is partially economic, it starts with a U.S. GAAP base and then makes some adjustments. At some point in the past, SST and S&P, the 185 was almost equivalent of SSP AA plus 3 to 5 billion. Over the basis of developments over the last couple of years, that translation is more like 200% would be equivalent of S&P 3 to 5 billion. We look at both measures. Obviously, we want to, and we would continue to maintain a very strong capital position. We remain in an excess capital position. And of course, that's how we would intend to continue to steer the company. And our specific stated goals with that excess capital, first and foremost, to invest it wisely in the business where we can, to grow the sustainable earnings and therefore allow the regular dividend to grow. If we can't do that, of course, then we look for ways to return it. Now, you've heard me say that before, and that's exactly the strategy we're going to continue to follow going forward. So we're above our targeted levels. We remain above our targeted levels. That provides us an opportunity to be able to flexibly respond to opportunities that that come up in the marketplace. And if those opportunities don't come up, while we continue to generate, and you'll see that from our Q1 results, continue to generate quite significant new capital through our P&L line, then, of course, we'll look for those ways to return that capital.
Okay, sorry, the response on the RBC, you talked about target capital specifically on the risk-bearing capital that you have, and there's still that billion-plus gap that's not, I don't think, explained by, unless I've misunderstood it by the comments, unless it's FX, but it seems a very large move for FX.
Yeah. There are a lot of different things, Andy, that go into it. But the three big ones that drove it down are the capital management actions that are not reflected in SST2, to be clear. Negative FX, and then just it's a marginal item, but the update on the negative impacts of all the actions that we took in the second half of 2014.
Okay. And just for clarity, no action to try and close that S&P and SST requirements. You're happy you're far enough above them both to not have to worry about it.
I have to apologize. I couldn't really follow the
sorry. So you're not taking any actions to try and get the S&P requirement closer or the buffer closer to where the SST buffer is at the moment. You're happy you're far enough above both of them to leave them as they are.
Well, I think what you would expect at any given time, we have a number of different metrics that we look at, and whatever the binding constraint would be, we look to address the binding constraint, but we're not going to go and simply drive off on the basis of one metric. The systems are different. The bases are different between S&P and SST. The reality is we have to live with both, and we also, of course, need to live with the various regulatory regimes that our various operating carriers are subject to around the globe. So that's our curse, but I think we're actually well-positioned to deal with that and I think continue to achieve the following outcomes. A solid financial position, one that makes us a very highly desired partner for our clients, a position that allows us to, I do think I use the word, be opportunistic, be flexible vis-a-vis opportunities that come to us in the marketplace, And at the same time, of course, and we've done that quite steadily now over the last couple of years, when we conclude that we really have more capital than we can foresee that we'll use, then we will look to return that. And of course, in that regard, these capital targets that I've mentioned to you do provide a little bit of an indication of there's still some room there.
Okay, thanks so much, David. Cheers.
Yeah. Next question comes from Anasuya Iyer, Jefferies. Please go ahead.
Oh, hello. I just have one question. It's on the PNC reserve releases, which are much lower than before, and I appreciate, obviously, from quarter to quarter there's volatility, but I just want to understand if this is sort of deliberate and what the evolution is going forward. So is it that you're running out of the reserve releases, or is it that you're just keeping more back so that there's a bigger cushion in the combined ratio? Thanks.
I'll let Matt go, and then I'll wrap it up.
Okay, so there is no deliberate plan at all to manage reserve releases one way or the other. In each quarter, we try to the best of our knowledge and to the best of our intentions to set our reserves as objectively as we can. When we do that, we implicitly make assumptions relative to the forward-looking loss-relevant inflation rate, so the loss trends. And then the quarter goes by, and the reality kicks in, and with the reality also an inflation kicks in, and if the inflation is lower, and or if the frequency, for whatever reason, of the losses are lower, this results in reserve releases. And if the opposite, the case, the reserves actually do increase. As you noted, we have variability from one quarter to the next and from one year to the next. There are quarters where the reserve releases are big, there are quarters where the reserve releases are smaller, and there are quarters and will be quarters where we actually see reserve additions, and it is absolutely impossible to draw any conclusions from the way how reserves develop from one quarter to the next.
So let me just add two comments to that. Our overall reserving policy has not changed. We're on a best estimate basis, I think you know. We don't plan for prior year developments one way or the other. No change there. You made reference specifically and correctly to the difference between the Q1 prior year developments in PNC Re and the Q1 developments last year, where you see a lower level of prior year developments this year. You may have noticed on Corporate Solutions you have exactly the opposite outcome, where the prior year reserve developments last year were actually negative, whereas the prior year developments this year were positive. So I think that just underlines the comments that Matt just made.
Okay, thank you. That's very clear.
Thank you.
Next question comes from Stefan Schumann, Bank Vontobel. Please go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon. Just two questions. First one on growth. As it's getting more challenging, especially also on the corporate solution side. Can you maybe just give us some feel of your thinking in terms of potential M&A there? Is that a tool you might take on using your excess capital to grow that field in the future now as the market is getting more difficult? And the second one on duration gap, I understand on Admin Re, you did lengthen basically duration. Can you just give us an update of duration gap for the P&C, Life and Health and Admin Re unit, please?
Okay, thanks, Stefan. So let me first address the growth question. So, you know, we started when we carved the corporate solutions business out of the broader reinsurance balance sheet a number of years ago. We started with an overall gross premium base of just above $2 billion, so $2.5 billion. of course, a relatively modest position in the marketplace. And we said to the market that over the course of the ensuing 5 years, we'd like to see that business grow. And we thought it would probably have an opportunity to grow, relatively speaking, more quickly because of the modest market position, if you think about it. It's also a very large market, so the combination of those two things led us to conclude that there was a real opportunity for a firm such as Swiss Re with all sorts of, I think, very strong attributes. Obviously, our brand, our knowledge capabilities, our footprint, our balance sheet, our ability to offer innovative solutions. And we set out on that course back end of 2010, beginning of 2011. I think we've been very true to that course. And the fact of the matter is, we've said all along that we're not going to be top-line driven. We're going to be driven by basically profitable growth, so bottom line. We gave an indication of a top-line objective for this year of between $4 to $5 billion, and I think we remain of the view that we're able to achieve that. But importantly, we said the bottom line is what drives us, and a quality portfolio is, of course, of essential importance to us. Now, given the pricing developments that started to develop during the course of the second half of last year, we already indicated at Q3 that we would perhaps moderate a little bit our growth, just reflecting the softening pricing environment. That continues, and I think we continue to be careful about where we place our capital. Having said that, the opportunity for us remains, I think, quite significant. And even in a softening environment, we were able to show, albeit at a lower level, still, I think, a very good outcome in Q1 of this year. If you do any quarter-on-quarter comparison, there's always going to be a little bit of a noise in there. I think Q1 of last year, we actually did a very large individual transaction with a client that flattered the Q1 number last year. I think we communicated that at the time as well. But overall, I think we remain committed to the business and of the view that there's still a very long-term profitable growth opportunity for us. The part of your question about M&A, we have utilized M&A in the past in corporate solutions. I'm thinking about our operations in Brazil, in Colombia. We haven't yet closed it. We still anticipate that the first half of this year, but the transaction we announced toward the end of last year in China. So it's an opportunity that I think that we are willing to exercise from time to time when we find a good mix that really helps us in further establishing our global footprint or extending a little bit our product capabilities. So it's something that I would say we continue to remain open for, but any acquisition, of course, has to make sense from both a strategic point of view but also from a financial point of view. As to your second question, so we remain broadly matched. We had the strategic short on during the course of the back half of 2013, in the first part of 2014, and then we close that out. At this point, we have an overall DVO1 of pretty close to 2, but it's more just a technical trading type of position. There's nothing strategic about it. We remain broadly matched.
Okay, so no big change. Yeah, that's very good. Thank you.
Next question comes from Frank Kopfinger from Asbank. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, everybody. My first question is on your Admin Re business and on the net realized gains. You said that the net realized gains were due to repositioning of your assets in preparation for Solvency II. You touched it already, but could you specifically elaborate what you did there? And I would be also interested whether this action freed up somehow capital within the Admin Re segment, and also whether similar actions are feasible for other European businesses.
So I'm obviously not going to speak about what other companies may be doing specific to Swiss.
No, for you, European.
Okay, specific to Swiss.
European segment.
Yeah, specific to Swiss Re, the answer of that question is actually quite straightforward. So we are positioning the portfolio for the matching adjustment. The matching adjustment is something that's, frankly, almost exclusively relevant for the UK market associated with the annuities business there. So, no, the answer to that question is it will not be a similar type of portfolio repositioning in our other European entities. Back to the UK situation. So basically what we did is we have sold some bonds, that were not eligible for inclusion, as we understand the rules and the manner in which the UK authorities will apply the guidance around the matching adjustment, and replace them with basically government bonds that will be eligible for acceptance under the matching adjustment. We haven't finalized that. We said we're going to do it in the first part of the year. I think we did a big part of it already in Q1. We want to have that basically in place basically by the midpoint of the year.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Next question comes from Thomas Fossett, HSBC. Please go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon. Two remaining questions on my side, I guess for David. The first question would be on the life and health reinsurance. Obviously, we are seeing Q1 a pretty dramatic normalization process of the margins and return on equity, and obviously you expect potentially the 15 years to develop favorably. Could you remind us how the target, the 10% to 12% target, return on equity target is calculated? Is that still based on the mid-June, on the June 2013 shareholders' equity of 5.5, or are you now, I would say, looking for 10-12, but more based on the current shareholders' equity of the division? And the second question, a very small one, will be on the tax rates. Obviously, rather low tax rate in Q1 on various one-off positive developments. Could you maybe update the guidance for what we should expect on a full year basis for the current year? Thank you.
Yeah, sure. So to the first question, no, we're not changing that at all. We said already back in the mid part of 2013 that we wanted to achieve by 2015 an ROE of between 10% and 12%. On the then current equity base of $5.5 billion. And the reason for doing that was basically to take the impact of unpredictable interest rates out of that equation. We don't know if interest rates will go up or go down. As it turns out, they've gone down, so the reported equity, of course, is somewhat inflated by unrealized gains. But we just maintain what we said already earlier, and we've repeated on several occasions during the course of last year, and not change that now, just based on one quarter's results. So we said 10 to 12% on the equity base that we had at the end of June 2013, which was $5.5 billion. As to your second question, indeed, we had a little bit of lower rate than what we would normally expect, just discrete items that came through during the course of the quarter. In terms of forward-looking thinking, I think that we've said, and we'll just maintain that, that it would be appropriate to think about a rate of 20-22%, something in that range.
We have a follow-up question from Mr. Michael Huffman, J.P. Morgan. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. I hope they haven't been asked, so apologies if they have. In the outlook, you talk about admin re deals in the UK, so it sounds quite imminent, and I just wonder if that's been asked, or if it's been asked, please ignore me. And then on the low claims, I just wondered, it's a couple of low claims. I know, obviously, Nat Cats, that's purely accidentally, but the low claims in terms of low man-made claims, is there something structural here? It feels quite odd, but yesterday, EULA, so this is specific to credit insurance, but there may be a read across, said yes, low interest rates do help because basically they because the cost of debt is very low, there are fewer insolvencies. But I'm not sure if there's any other thing here. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Michael. I'll take the first and then hand over to Matt for the second. So, look, these deals are chunky in the UK market where Admin Re is active. I wish I had a crystal ball. I could tell you exactly when some of these transactions may materialize. It's very difficult. These things have a gestation period, I think, that is at least equal to that of an elephant, which I think, I don't know the exact number of months, but it's a relatively a long period of time. We have, I think, very worthwhile discussions now with a number of different participants in the UK market. We have, I think, in that regard, a healthy pipeline. But to predicting the timing of these actually coming to fruition, I think, would be a dangerous sport. So I'm going to avoid that. Just commit, as we have done earlier, to the comment that we think it's an attractive market and that we're well positioned for what we think will be a number of attractive opportunities that will come to the marketplace. Let me then ask Matt to follow up on the second question.
So on the man-made claims frequency side, I would answer it as follows. There are some structural elements in play, and I'm happy to talk a little bit about them. And then there are also some cyclical elements in play. So it's not completely random that right now we don't see a very high frequency of man-made losses. On the more structural side, for instance, flying today is safer than flying was 20 years ago, which of course is very good for, especially for those who fly and fly frequently. The same is true on the motor side. The cars today have better safety features than they used to have in the past. The speed controls are tighter. Driving under influence is better enforced than it was in the past. So the motor frequency over the year has come down. And we believe chances are bigger than the opposite is the case, that this trend will continue also in the future. So these are more the structural or secular trends. And then there are some cyclical trends. Some of them are linked to the economy, for instance. Right now, the economy, I would describe it as slowly improving on a global basis. And this is a situation which, for instance, is good for trade credit and also for surety. But it's also good, for instance, on the property side, because in such an environment, this means manufacturing, for instance, they have enough work and enough revenue to continue to invest in safety and risk management, but they are not operating at an excessive load which requires to make shortcuts. So right now we are based on the economy in an environment which we actually like very much from at least from an underwriting perspective.
Oh, that's very helpful. Thank you.
We have another follow-up question from Mr. Andy Brookfield. Barclays, please go ahead.
Oh, hi there. Just a couple of quick ones. I think the adjustment to you mentioned on the life and health side, premium adjustment, was something that was recommended by FINMA, something they come back to you with. Can you confirm that, and also whether there are any other areas that FINMA's sort of checking or having making some suggestions to you about? Number two, just on the investment strategy side, you had a pretty tough ride of it last year with the short duration position you took early in the year. I think that was disclosed in your EVM. Now, of course, US GAAP doesn't really help us understand the economics of your investment strategy. Are you able to give us a sense in the first quarter how that's gone? I'm assuming, because you're reasonably well matched, that there's probably not too much noise there. But if you can just confirm one way or the other, that'd be very helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, I'll take the second one first. Indeed, we took it a little bit on the chin last year. I think that's the only conclusion you can have looking at it in hindsight. So the short position in 2014 was clearly not a very attractive position to have. We closed it, as you know, during the course of Q3. Actually, in 2013, it had been a positive, so it contributed to a positive economic result in 2013. But that's the way it goes. You're absolutely correct, Andy. We basically are running on a match basis right now, so there's no real significant impact one way or the other in Q1. Back to your first question on our life and health model. So we are on in a constant dialogue with FINMA regarding our various models, and they've looked at all the different modules over the course of the past year. We are operating under approval. Sometimes they're limited approvals or approvals for a limited period of time, basically as they constantly provide us with feedback, and they want to have a regular review of the various models that we have. The adjustment that we talk about here, I think, was reflecting some feedback that FIMA had given us, meanwhile, 2 or 3 years ago. We, meanwhile, have submitted that back to FIMA, and they have agreed to it for use going forward. At this point, I think there's only one relatively minor, let me check the use of the word minor, but there's only one subcomponent of our model that hasn't yet received a sign-off from FINMA, although I would just like to caution the way FINMA manages this process is they give approval for use for a specific period of time, which basically then drives a review after that period of time has lapsed. But we feel as though we're in a really good position with our model approvals with FINMA. A lot of the requests that we get from them at this point have more to do with issues such as documentation and whatnot, which are all quite relevant, but probably not likely to have that much impact on the absolute calculated figures. The adjustments to the life and health model, as I mentioned, were focused on a more granular, targeted look at the premium risk that we run on some of the longer-term programs, and as a result had a more significant impact. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Dave. Cheers.
Next question is a follow-up question from Mr. William Hawking, KBW. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks. Sorry to drag the call out. This is very technical. But, David, could you just repeat and clarify what you said about the UK matching adjustment for Admin Re? I originally thought that the reason you were switching between UK government bonds was just a duration issue. So I assumed lengthening to improve matching so that you could get the matching adjustment. But then you did make reference to the eligibility. So is there another issue that for some reason some UK government bonds are not eligible and others are, or have I misunderstood?
I think it's just a misunderstanding your part. So I don't know what you were specifically referring to in terms of your original understanding. It was basically just swapping out bonds that were not eligible for bonds that were eligible. So we did some swapping to really better match the duration of the annuities books that we have. It's just that straightforward, William. There's no further driver or background. So just following the guidance that we've received in terms of the types of assets and the nature of the matching that would be required in order to fulfill the expectations around the matching adjustment. That's it.
But it was a duration issue that was driving the change.
Yeah, certainly is not a quality issue related to UK gilt.
Yeah. Okay, duration. Thank you.
We have another follow-up question from Mr. Thomas Fossett, HSBC. Please go ahead.
Yes, thanks. Just wanted to come back on the on previous comments from Matt on the man-made claims side, and I really wanted to better understand what is a Swiss Re underwriting strategy regarding the oil industry at the time being, and how potentially you are currently reflecting that a persistent low price, oil price level may have some negative implication in terms of cash flow generation and need for cost cutting on all these companies, potentially, you know, removing part of the safety or safety control or safety measures they were implementing in the past, which in turn could lead to some claims pick up. Is it something that you are considering? Is it something that forced you to adjust your underwriting strategy and maybe exposure to the segment since the start of the year? Thank you.
Okay, so we are indeed active in the energy sector and as part of the energy sector also in the oil sector on both the corporate solution side and the reinsurance side. On the costing, I do agree with you. The oil price does have an impact in certain lines of business, and we are taking that into account. In addition to that, we are or have been running scenarios What if the oil price continues to be low for a very long time? And we completed this analysis and the numbers that come out of these scenario calculations are absolutely absorbable and digestible. So we are it has an impact. We are taking it into account. And I ask you to not worry about it, please.
Okay, I think we have no more questions, so we're coming to an end of our Q&A session. Thank you very much to all of you. Please do not hesitate to contact any member of the Swiss Re Investor Relations team if you have follow-up questions regarding today's results or future events. Thank you again, everybody, for your participation today. Thank you.